And welcome to another Cine Stories podcast. I'm your host, Brian Dick. This week, I sat down with writer, director, and producer Phil Guidry to talk about his new movie, Savage Land, an unconventional take on a horror genre staple. Fair warning, we dive right into talking about the film, so there are spoilers galore. This movie is being released this Friday, February 24th, across multiple platforms, which include Amazon Instant, iTunes, Google Play, via YouTube, Vimeo On Demand, among others. But before we get into our podcast, a bit of business. We are still accepting submissions for the 2017 Feature Retreat. Our final deadline is April 5th. For more information, please visit our website at www.cinestory.org. Here at the Cine Stories podcast, we're happy to be part of the larger Podomatic network, which has introduced us to other amazing podcasts. One of those is the Erie Canal Theater, who, in the spirit of Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater, are putting together long-form narratives through their podcasts. So check them out and their current offering, Laughageddon. And now, on with our podcast and the conversation with Phil Guidry.
You were there. I forget that you were at Comic-Con. The very first question we got... Do you remember in the Q&A? The first question we've ever done about this project on any level, after the screening at Comic-Con, this guy gets up. He's like, first of all, I really enjoyed the film. Really well done. Great suspense. Love the photos, the whole thing. But what's up with the race baiting? Why did you make it such a race baiting movie? Like, That's right out of the box. I was like, well, thank you for the compliment. I'm glad you enjoyed the film. It's nice to have a fan. I mean, because we had prepped some things that we thought would be asked, right. But that was the last thing that we expected to get, so... Listen, we kind of had it coming. It doesn't mean I wasn't surprised to get it right out of the box, you know. So,
well, and also the fact that you're now getting the release this week when, you know, I think just today Trump has readjusted his immigration guidelines / ban.
Right, which is part of me wants to thank him because, you know, he is keeping this in the zeitgeist. So, you know, I'm not going to thank him, but part of me, you know.
But I think immigration is one of those universal things. Not universal. We're never going to lose it.
Right. I agree. And by the way, that's something that we noticed because the film played, and we can get into this at some point, but the film played festivals in San Diego, Arizona, Utah, the UK, Mexico, New York, Virginia. And in the UK, they had immigration stuff happening around that same time. In Mexico, they had those issues. In New York, it was a conversation piece. So at various points in time, whenever and wherever it happened to be playing, to your point, it tied into whatever was happening in the news. So it's not going anywhere, right. You know. So,
well, before we get too far in the weeds on Savage Land, I kind of want to just jump back. And I always like to find out if there was sort of a seed that was planted when you were a kid. Like, was there a TV show? Was there a one movie? You know, or a series of movies that you saw that wanted you, you know, that inspired you to get into entertainment.
Growing up, there's a memory that I have, and it may not have actually happened as I remember it, but the memory seems pretty clear. I was probably 7 or 8, and in a 1 week span, I watched 2 films. One was the original King Kong. My dad was a big fan of the classic Universal horror monster movies, and we watched King Kong together. I realize for movie buffs, it's not Universal, it's RKO. But anyway, we watched the original King Kong. And I was so captivated by the story. And obviously, spoiler alert, like the ape is killed. He shot off the Empire State Building and he crashes to the street. And I remember crying. I was sad that this, you know, this character that I'd been following, this giant monster, had been killed. A few days later, they showed the miniseries Jesus of Nazareth on TV. You may remember these from.
Yeah.
So... Jesus of Nazareth happens. We watch it as a family. And at the end of the miniseries, spoiler alert, Jesus is also killed. And when it's over, I watched it and I was pretty stoic. I watched it and I was, I guess, moved. And I thought it was a fairly well-made miniseries. I don't really remember much about it other than the ending. But I didn't cry. And so I remember my parents asking me, just let me get this straight, Phil. So you cried when King Kong died, but not when Jesus died. What's wrong with you exactly? So that was definitely one. I mean, I think you and I are kind of the same era and vintage. Like, I grew up watching the Spielberg movies and Raiders and Jaws and Lucas and Star Wars and all that stuff. And
but the first movie I remember crying at was La Bamba.
Wow, that's
La Bamba destroyed me.
Wow, they flipped that coin and he ends up on the plane. And yeah. I mean, that one, you know, you had the Big Bopper and you know, God rest all their souls. It was a good one. 1987, I think, which was 87. By the way, was a great year for movies. You had Predator and RoboCop and The Lost Boys. I think La Bamba. Someone will double check me, but I feel like 87 was the year. So those are movies that I really loved when I was a kid. And coming out here, you know, I ended up at USC as an undergrad, and obviously a lot of those guys had spent time there when they were coming up, and it was in that era that I really, you know, that 1980s era of films that I think was originally drawn to movies, and then once you get to college, you start to broaden your horizons, you start watching films from other eras and other places, and actually that's when my love, I think, of horror movies came in, because this, you know, Savage Land is obviously not a straight horror film. It's kind of a hybrid. It has a documentary vibe, but that sort of feeling, that very raw, gritty, realistic take on horror is something that was, I think, not very 80s. That's more of kind of a 70s thing, like a Texas Chainsaw Massacre, late 70s, early 80s feel maybe.
Right.
That was an era that I think we wanted to capture with the film. That was definitely something that we talked about. We talked about Chainsaw. And the other thing, movies we talked about, and I started to really get into these when I was in college and beyond, was documentaries. Now, obviously, Savage Land is made to look and feel like a documentary, and it's got that documentary vibe. But that documentary ethos is something that we kept in mind from the start. There's a great, great documentary that actually has spawned an entire series of follow-up films called Paradise Lost.
Right.
About the West Memphis Three. That original documentary, Paradise Lost, the child murders at Robin Hood Hills, that just tore me up when I saw it. And I was disturbed and moved by it for years. So from the very first day we started talking about Savage Land, that was one of the keystone films. So as much as I'd love to say Halloween and Chainsaw and Jaws and all these other movies, Paradise Lost was, I think, on that very short list as far as movies that influence us.
Well, where did the seed of the idea for Savage Land come from?
I was working on the Jim Rome show, and Jim Rome was burning, the sports talk show down in Orange County, with another friend from grad school. Went to UCLA together for grad school. And for years, we had, even back in school, we talked about making a film together. I think that's one of the benefits, by the way, of going to a film school or to a program. It's a place where you meet like-minded people. You find out who likes things like you, and you keep in touch with them. So Dave Whelan and I were friends from grad school, and we worked together at Rome. And for years, we had talked about we should do something. We should find a way to make something. And in that frame of mind, I had the initial idea of doing a horror movie that was basically told through still photographs. You know, there's a great Antonioni film called Blow Up that's essentially the plot revolves around something that's hidden in the background of a photo. And I love that idea for horror for two reasons. One, because it hadn't really been done before. And two, because it seemed like a good low-budget, micro-budget way to tell a story. We knew we couldn't afford effects for a bunch of frames, but man, we could probably pull off one or two frames really well.
But also in horror and even a thriller, it's what's hidden in the shadows.
Exactly.
You know.
Exactly. And actually, not to get film nerd with this, but we've all heard the stories of how Jaws worked so well because the shark didn't work, right? Spielberg couldn't get the shark to work, so he had to kind of imply things. And to your point, it was in the shadows. It was what was in your imagination in those spaces in between. And we thought, both for budgetary constraints, but also for storytelling reasons, we thought that would translate well to a photograph. But to be clear, I mean, that's all that I had, was a seed of an idea. Let's tell kind of a horror story in the same format. Dave Whelan was, like I said, working with me at Rome at the time. And right around 2010, 2011, this is when the immigration law in Arizona was really first coming to the fore. And it was really controversial. It was on a lot of people's minds. We were having conversations about the law, by the way, on both sides. It wasn't just one way or the other. I think most reasonable people have their perspectives on this, but can at least understand where the other side's coming from.
Right.
So we talked about the law, and it was his suggestion to set it in the Arizona-Mexico border region. That was really the big, I think, master stroke that set this thing in motion. And then we have a third filmmaker as part of our trio, Simon Herbert. And Simon, who's British, and I mean this in the most loving, complimentary way, is a very critical person. He brought a critical eye to this, and he was kind of our vice president of logic as far as this goes. I mean, that was really the thing that he brought from the start was a strong sense of story and logic and making sure, does this make sense? Could this be plausible? Are there any big holes? Are we missing something? And that presence was really key to this thing. So you bring Simon's sense of logic and order and constantly probing questions and poking holes in things to the idea, the concept of telling a horror story with a photograph, and mix in the idea of the border region and this politics swirling around it, and that's how the story came to be.
So did you ever construct a, obviously it wasn't a traditional script, so how did you construct your story once you had that idea?
They always say that there's a few things you should never do as a filmmaker. You should never go into a film without a script. You should never work with kids. You should never work with animals. You should, if you're making an indie film, you should have a minimum number of locations and characters. We broke every single one of those rules. But the script one is interesting because you and I are, I think, of like minds. We're writers. We come into this as screenwriters, and Simon and David are also screenwriters by trade. So the three of us should have known better. But what we did want, we wanted a realistic, improvisational sort of way of telling the story. So what we created was a working scriptment. It was a very detailed treatment that had the story beats laid out, and in large part how they ended up playing out in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
With lines and beats and moments that we wanted to hit. But the way we shot it was we encouraged the actors to essentially be interviewed and to give us their improvisational takes as long as they could wind their way back and actually hit those points so that our editors, God bless them, could piece it together.
Well, it feels like sometimes you even got away from actors and just did some on the street interviews and used snippets of what people said, to propel the story.
We definitely did. And that was something we decided from the start that we wanted. We wanted that feeling because, by the way, real life has drama. It has all the conflict and character that you could possibly want. So, and by the way, people also have strong opinions on this subject matter.
Right.
Not zombies and supernatural and monsters.
Which you never actually mentioned the Z word at any point in your movie.
Right, it's a supernatural film that we don't come out and say it. So we wanted that man on the street vibe. We wanted that take. We wanted that sense of unpredictability and spontaneity, which we got. And we got it, I think, in part by a few techniques. One was that we cast real people wherever we could. And in a few cases, like Lawrence Ross, who plays the reporter in the movie, and Renee Davies, who plays the psychotherapist in the film, we cast people to play the roles they play in real life. Those two people, that's their day job. So we were able to get a natural feel from having people do what they normally do.
Right.
We also encouraged them to just take chances, and it became more conversational. You know, the way we shot the film was not unlike the conversation you and I are having, where we're sitting there and the camera's rolling, but the fact is we're just talking and we know where we want to get to and we'll prod you to get there. But how you get there is sort of up to you. And a lot of times what happens is you get something unpredictable.
Did you give them either the scriptment or sort of this is the story, this is what, these are the events that happened in this town? And that was, before that you went into the questioning.
It's a great question. We gave them exactly what we wanted them to know, which was the bare minimum. We gave them details. We gave them sides and lines and general suggestions for things. But no one read the entire script. This is a key thing. No one in our entire film read the entire script or the entire treatment. The only people who had it were the three filmmakers. So the people coming in for their interviews, they only knew their perspective. They only knew their side of the story.
Okay.
So when they came in, they knew what they had to say and what they wanted to get across. But they didn't know how it would be meshed or how it would be played against other characters in the movie. And we thought by doing that, it would make it seem more realistic. They weren't going to be playing off of someone else. They wouldn't be actorly. They would just be people with a point of view, which is really what we wanted to film.
Well, yeah. I mean, that was one of the things I found myself doing while I was watching it was looking up the town's names of, oh, are these real places? Yeah. And that, how much of the information that I'm being given is real, and what is fictionalized.
We wanted that for two reasons. One, because we thought that would make it seem more realistic. That would play into the experience of the film. And two, that was more fun for us. We wanted to have it cross over and blur the lines. We live in a world where, sadly, that's happening more and more in the real news media, right, in our real world. And so we thought, let's use this to our advantage. Not that we knew the direction this was going several years ago, but we thought this would be more fun, a way to play into it. And to
in 2 weeks, Trump will be, you know, talking about the tragedy, you know,
in Sagrada Cristo. Exactly. I mean, it's gonna happen. So we definitely wanted that crossover. There was a film that came out when I was in college called The Blair Witch Project. And one of the things that they did really well was they intentionally blurred the lines between what is real and what's not. Whatever people make of the movie, however well it has or hasn't aged, and I haven't seen it in years, it was incredibly effective at blurring those lines. And we thought we could take the same type of approach in terms of the documentary filmmaking style of the movie. Usually when people try and have mock news in movies, they do one of a few things. They have a newscast, which often comes out really fake. Unless you want to spend extra money for the CNN logo in the corner, it's going to look fake. They usually will put newspapers, but they'll print up one full page of a newspaper and show you the full page. The reality is, if you see a real documentary, they don't show you the full cover of the New York Times. They show you a very close-up snippet of the news story in question, maybe a few lines and a few words. We wanted to go the extra mile in terms of that realism, so the maps we had made, the editorial cartoons we had made, these things we thought would enhance the believability of this place actually existing, to get the reaction you just mentioned, which is, let's go online, let's see if this is real.
Have you done a count on how many different types of media that you used in it because of the newspaper, you know, the sit-down interviews?
Well, we lost count, but at one point I know that we had, well, I can tell you the most important count is that we had two editors when we really thought we were going to have one. And I think I need to take a moment to talk about these editors, because they were dealing with these different types of media. And by the way, not just different types of media formats in terms of, now here's the newspapers, here's editorial cartoons, here's comic books. We have a few comic book pieces of art in the film. But also, we shot on so many different cameras. I mean, when we started shooting this film, HD was not the standard. That was kind of an extra bonus. So we shot on different forms of media. Some days we'd be ready to shoot, we'd lose access to that camera, so we had to change the story a little bit to explain why this footage is on a lower quality camera than the previous scene. And we had two editors involved in the film. The first editor is named Matthew Smith, and he was with us from the start. And he started assembling all this really rough, raw footage. And when I say rough and raw, not even the sense of a typical indie film. I mean, this was documentary style. We shot probably a 21 ratio. And so he's having to piece it together with all these formats and all these different styles, different pieces of media. And he really helped us keep the thing on track for a long time as we were shooting. As we found the movie, he was there with us the whole time. The second editor is also named Matt Eagleson. He came in and brought, I think, the finishing touches to the film. The very visceral, dynamic style that the film evolved into was because of his eye and his style. We never would have gotten to the film we had without Matt Smith, and we wouldn't have had the film we had without Matt Eagleson. And I think if we had reversed the order of those two editors, we wouldn't have had it. So I think it's important to note that even though the three filmmakers had a vision and we shot this and we compiled it and we always knew what we wanted it to be, it required two editors with two very different skill sets at two very different times to help bring all these forms of media together. So I think that's a key thing that we've never forgotten. I think it bears repeating.
At what was one of the big turns while you're in the middle of putting this together that, you know, that was like almost sort of a eureka moment?
The biggest test of a film like this for me was patience. First, I don't mean just in the day-to-day indie filmmaking patience, in the sense that you have camera problems, you don't have the budget to shut a street down, so you're stealing shots. We had that, but it required patience over the period of several months and several years. You know, there's the expression about good, fast, and cheap. You can have two out of three, but you can't have all three. We often were sacrificing fast just to make it, well, we hope as good as it can be, but also do as cheaply as possible. Right. I mentioned Matt Smith before. He had helped us string together a film that I think was coherent and made sense. But the filmmakers, to go back to the script question, we hadn't really answered a nagging question in the story structure, which was when and how to personalize the victims of this story. Right. In the film, there's 57 people in a town called Sangre de Cristo, Arizona, who are 56 of whom are wiped out overnight by presumably the one person who was left standing covered in their blood. These are 56 people we want to humanize. We want to make them seem like they were real people with real lives and real backstories. In early versions of the film, we had them all very much front-loaded. We set up who the characters were. We thought it was important to set up these this teacher and these children at this preschool. These people work in this field. These people live in this town. These people live in this house. And so the film took a long time to get going, and we just couldn't really figure it out. So one of the eureka moments was when we just decided to just hit the moment the mayhem begins at a certain time limit. We said, we've got to get it to here. And everything we rip out, we can find a home for it if we can, but we've got to get to this time limit. So once we started doing that, we were able to sprinkle in those details as you move through the night, as you move through the town. Right. We're able to kind of personalize, okay, now we're here at the church. That's where we're going to introduce these characters, and that's where they are. And that helped us, I think, condense the time frame. It was almost like that... If you remember reading Mad Magazine as a kid, the back page was the fold-in.
Right, yeah.
We had to fold in the time frame of the movie. Once we did that, I think it really helped us click. And so, and that was in our transitional period between editors. So I'd like to think that if we had that eureka moment with the first editor, he may have been able to go the distance with us because it was on us. We just didn't solve that story question until it was late in the game. But as they say, and this cliche is totally true, you write the movie three times. You write it on the page, you write it with the camera, and you write it in the editing bay. And that's really what happened for us with this movie.
Now, at the point that you started Savage Land, had you started working in sports television and working in sports docs?
I was working for the Jim Rome Show and hadn't had any sports doc experience. Okay. I'd done an Olympics with NBC as a writer. I had been involved in some short pieces that we had produced for the current show that I'd been working on for Jim Rome, but I had not done that. So over the course of making the film, I ended up moving over to the NFL Network, where I've been involved in a number of documentaries of varying lengths, everything from 5 minutes to 2 hours.
Right.
And the things that I was learning on the film, I was applying to the sports docs. And because this took so long, the things I learned in the sports docs began applying to the film. So it was kind of a crossover education for me. I was learning from one and applying it to the other throughout the time. But when we started, I had never really done anything of this magnitude. I'd made student films. I had worked on shorts with friends. I had written features, had sold a couple things, had never really, though, spent time on a set. And just as crucially, time in production and time in pre-production. I mean, making a film like this with all these different pieces was... it was a test of every aspect of my brain. I mean, on the one hand, you're a screenwriter because you're working on the script. You are a babysitter and you're arranging logistics. You are talking to attorneys to get releases and forms. You are trying to be a salesman and convince a helicopter operator to send you up with some cameras at a fraction of the rate.
Right.
You are having to research online the best way to mix blood for costumes and gore. You are doing everything. I mean, one of the people we listed in the film was an architect named Mike Hutaff, who essentially designed an AutoCAD three-dimensional version of Sangre de Cristo so that we could move through the town in very animatic form and lay out what happened the way that a real documentary would do it. So I'm having to learn about architecture and design and how he puts it together so that I know the right questions to ask him. So when I ask him, hey, why can't we move up through this building and around the corner, I have to know why he's going to tell me we can or can't do it. So having to do all these things where you're having to be an accountant because there's a production budget you've got to stick to, and you've got to be a director, and you've got to work on lights, and you've got to be a psychiatrist to people, and you've got to be a promoter and a huckster, and all these different hats, It became almost a grad school PhD on its own. And so working on the sports docs, I think, was definitely helping me do this stuff. It was helping me organize all these thoughts to keep all these plates spinning at the same time.
And was it pretty balanced between you, Simon, and David in wearing all those different hats?
For the most part, yes. If I'm being totally honest, Simon was the logistical glue of this project and has been from the start. I think that's more of his nature. He worked in the art world for a long time. He was used to putting together galleries and big openings and big staged events. So he brought that experience. His wife, Ellen, who also worked with us with casting, she has been involved in the business for a while. And so the logistical aspects of the film, I think, were really on his and her shoulders for a lot of the film. David and I were, I think, more of the organized, but also we were more likely to want to just try things. You know, for myself personally, I have been more prone to flights of fancy. You know, we'd get out to a location, I would say, hey, let's try this while we're out here.
Right.
And that requires a chain reaction of planning that wasn't done. It's now got to react to what's happened. Simon was, I would say, the organizational whipcracker of this thing. He was, from the start, someone who put in a lot of the sweat and elbow grease that got this thing moving and kept the thing on track. He also, I think, and this is a key part of the film that you and I know have talked about in the past, he helped produce the photographs in a way that I think makes the film work. So creatively, logistically, Dave and I think put in more than our share, but the heavy lifting day to day, almost in line producer capacity, fell to Simon.
Now, the photographs that you mentioned, was that probably the biggest snag that you hit during the production of it?
Definitely. We went and shot several rolls of black and white film out in the desert, and we staged them. We had done camera tests. Some of them came out great, some of them didn't. But there were two issues with the photographs in the beginning. Number one, we have an excellent DP in this film. Turner Jumonville is great. I mean, he had never shot a feature before he worked with us, but he shot several since then. A Sundance documentary, a 30 for 30 for ESPN. He's since gone on to do many things, and it's well-deserved. He's excellent. But his stuff is gorgeous. His stuff looks like a $200 million Hollywood movie. We wanted, at times, especially with the photographs, we wanted gritty and raw. So we get these photographs back, and they were perfectly framed. They were gorgeous. They looked like things you'd hang up on your wall. They didn't look like the crazed, violent spree that the photographs are supposed to necessarily capture.
Right.
That was really on us, though, not his shooting style, because we didn't stage the photographs to be active. Initially, they were very static. We'd have people sort of pose in the corner in a bush, and we would take photographs and assume that would work. But what we realized afterwards was, when we got the photos back, we realized these photos are capturing action. So there needs to be action. So the successive rounds of photos we shot, we looked at photographs. We looked at war photographs, sports photographs. We went through every piece of black and white photography we get our hands on to look for how the motion looked, for blurring. We wanted smoke. We wanted dust. We wanted action. We wanted, you know, when you are in a violent encounter, there are details like, you know, if you have long hair, the hair is not going to be in focus. It's going to be moving because you're shaking your head. Things that we had to get right in successive rounds of photography. But we also had a little bit of Photoshop. You know, we pride ourselves in shooting these as naturalistic as we could. And many of them are untouched. They came out of the camera just as they appear in the film. But there were a few where we wanted to doctor the photographs. But this is a key distinction, because in this age of CGI and Photoshop and Adobe After Effects, we didn't want to add things to the photos. We didn't want to add burning buildings and body parts and things of that nature.
Right.
What we did to the photographs was actually taking things away more often than not. So removing a little bit of shade, adding some shade on someone's face, removing some of the clarity, taking some light away here and there. You know, it was things that kind of disguise and create shadows to have that effect, as we talked about, of you're hiding the shark from the audience, so to speak, rather right. than showing it. So there was Photoshop, but we really wanted to focus on having as naturalistic a feel with these photographs as possible.
I also think in the movie you guys did sort of a Hitchcock shower scene where you actually never see any, like a knife piercing the skin. You know, you never see a body part, you know, right. You know, it's just all alluded to. And then, you know, the rooms that are doused in blood.
Well, look, if you're going to make a horror or suspense film and have people reference Hitchcock, we'll take that any day of the week. We really, really, though, did try to have that approach. We want to imply things. What's awesome is that there are we've had multiple screenings of this film in multiple states, all over the country, and in several other countries. In every screening we've ever had, everyone who's ever watched the film, we have had things that are in those photos that people don't see the first time. And we have had people seeing things in the photos that aren't actually there. That was our, I would say, one of the biggest compliments we received. People see things that are not there, but then they're missing things that are actually kind of obvious when they're pointed out that people don't see the first time. And I think that goes to what you're saying. It's the implied violence. It's the implied threat. It's what's happening maybe a few inches off the edge of the frame. And that, to me, that's cinema. That's really what it is. You know, this, not to get film nerdy again with this, but this is 24 frames a second. This is suspension of disbelief. This is the imagination filling in those gaps between those frames that are speeding through in front of your face. So instead of trying to hide those things, we just decided to let those gaps take over. And I think over the course of our 82-minute film, those gaps create something that is a very visceral and powerful experience for the audience.
Now, you kind of leave it open-ended at the end. So is there going to be a chance for a Savage Land 2?
What we'd love to do, and what we've talked about actually from the start, is we envision this film as almost a launching point to tell a bigger story. The version of the story that I think we would love to collectively tell going forward is a little bit of a hybrid. Obviously, we'd want to pick up with where things leave off, because the implication, without spoiling the film, the implication is that this is not an isolated thing and that there's going to be more of this down the road.
Right.
But we also would like to start actually with a little bit of a prequel storytelling. You know, the way we envision it is, imagine the Border Patrol the night that this happens. Imagine the people in town. Imagine what things were like in Sangre de Cristo when this menace starts to unfold. So the idea would be, we give you a little bit of a taste of the precursor, but then it becomes a big sprawling epic. You know, one of the things...
A little more scripted, though.
A little more scripted. And maybe a few actors that people have heard of, just to sprinkle in with some of the real people.
Yeah.
Although, this is something that we're really proud of about the film. And I would say this hopefully can be encouraging to anyone who's trying to make a film, who's a writer or a director. They say that if you have a low budget, you should shoot in a few locations, have as few speaking parts as possible, have as few locations as possible. We went the complete opposite direction. This film was shot in 5 or 6 states. It was shot in the U.S. and Mexico. We had about 30 locations. We have about 100 speaking parts. We have helicopters. We have visual effects. We have police cars. We have horses. We wanted to tell a huge epic story regardless of the budget. And it required ingenuity and cutting corners and taking risks and patience above all. But
yeah, because all those locations were permitted. You got permits for all those, right?
Sure. Yes. Yeah. Right on. Whatever you say. So, but it required us to just use our imagination. And we want to tell a big sweeping story. We want this to feel like an epic. You know, there are days when we'd go out there and we'd see Turner shooting this shot, and we look through the viewfinder, and it looks like a John Ford movie. It's awesome. And so that feeling of scope and sweep was something we wanted. Even though this is a micro budget movie, it shouldn't have a micro budget feel. That's what we thought. And so hopefully when people see it, it will feel big and epic, like it's the start of something that's sprawling, rather than a very contained kind of haunted house movie, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, Phil, thanks for sitting down with me today and talking about Savage Land.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure. We'll have to do it again when Savage Land 2 comes out.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks a lot.